From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Tuesday, January 21st, when Rochester joined other cities across the nation in recognizing a day of racial healing. During an event at City Hall, officials reported on progress with an initiative designed to provide direction for improving equity in Rochester and other communities that are participating. Over the last year, the Let's Get Real Race, Equity, and Leadership Initiative has hosted workshops, seminars, and training sessions for City of Rochester employees who joined open discussions about race. It's not always easy. In a survey, some participants shared that they were confused about the differences between race, racial equity, diversity, and inclusion, that they sometimes or rarely set aside their own discomfort to talk about race, and that more engagement in particular with the Hispanic and Latino community is needed at City Hall. That's just some of the feedback that team members found valuable as they enter year two of the project. Mayor Lovely Warren did not attend the event but provided a statement saying Rochester is, quote, committed to not looking away to address racism and racial inequalities, end quote. She added that the city government is looking within public policies to dismantle divisive practices and procedures. This hour, we discuss what the REAL team has learned after its first year of work and how the findings will be applied to action plans for 2020. It's a discussion about how to have difficult conversations, how individual actions can contribute to change, and the structural and systemic issues in our city that need to be addressed in order to create a more inclusive community. And I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Willie Joe Lightfoot is the Vice President of Rochester City Council. Welcome back to the program. Thanks
thank
for
you,
being
Evan.
Here.
Good morning, and thank you for being
good
here.
Afternoon now,
Willie. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Right.
You
You're
got
right.
it.
I'm still stuck in morning.
I hear you. Hello to Hank Rubin, who is the founding director of the Frederick Douglass Center for Collaborative Leadership, a program of Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here, Hank.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here.
And Tina Foster is here, Executive Director of Volunteer Legal Services of Monroe County. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Tina said before the program, I'm a civil rights lawyer. It's a shorthand way to describe
that's
it.
It's a lot shorter than the official title.
Well, I'll ask both Tina and Hank this off the bat. Tell us what your work often entails then, Tina.
Well, I am the executive director of Volunteer Legal Services Project, which is a local organization which has for the past 40 years recruited attorneys in the community to represent low-income people with serious civil matters, non-criminal matters, including eviction, domestic violence, family law matters, bankruptcies, financial hardships, that sort of thing. And in that role, I have an opportunity to know sort of the client base, the target population of our low-income community. And also, we have a volunteer panel of about 1,500 attorneys in town in Rochester who are providing these services. They're the same attorneys that work at the major corporations and law firms in town, but they're volunteering their time to give back to the community and serving those folks. In my previous life, I was a civil rights litigator and for 20 years did that work. So I believe that's why I was invited to participate.
All right, very good. Well, thanks for being here. Hank Rubin, tell us what the mission of FDFI is. That's the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives.
Well, the mission of FDFI goes back to its abolitionist roots. We claim ourselves to be an abolitionist and an anti-racist organization working to undo racism and working to fight racism and the impacts of structural and institutional and interpersonal racism at all its levels. We moved to Rochester. This is actually the family of Frederick Douglass, which interestingly is also the family of Booker T. Washington, but we could talk about that on another show. This is the family moved to Rochester in order to follow up on the question of what would Frederick Douglass do if he saw Rochester today and he had a chance to impact the dynamics of the city. So we're looking at the juncture of racism and leadership in large part in Rochester, knowing that we have a lot of very powerful and capable leaders. We have a lot of conversation and clarity of the issues of racism, around the issues of racism, and a commitment to tackle them. But somehow or other, we as a community haven't achieved what we ought to achieve in terms of resolving racism and improving the quality of life in an equitable way for everybody. So we're working with leaders in order to focus on how we can do leadership better in an anti-racist context.
Well, thanks. We want to mention to our listeners that we did invite the city of Rochester, and they did not respond to our request for them to join this conversation. But Willie Lightfoot's here, and as not only as the vice president of Rochester City Council, but as someone who's been involved with this, let's talk about what Let's Get Real is, first of all. What is the Let's Get Real project?
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to say the city of Rochester is represented. It's represented by me. I am the vice president of City Council, as well as I am one of the core team members of this particular initiative. The Let's Get Real initiative, Evan, was born out of municipalities wanting to know how to handle racial tension in the wake of the Ferguson uprising. As a result of that Ferguson uprising, the mayor of Ferguson reached out to NLC, the National League of Cities, asking for some best practices on how to deal with that racial tension that they were having in their community. NLC did not have an answer for that. And they realized that they needed to build something within their organization to begin to deal with structural racism, police and community relations, and deal with uprisings that happen within communities. So they, in turn, chose six cities. Rochester was one of six cities chosen to go to New Orleans for technical assistant cohort that was based around racial equity and leadership. A group of us was commissioned by the mayor to go down to get more information on how can we begin to lead in a conversation around race, equity, and leadership in the city of Rochester.
So we're going to talk coming up here about a survey of nearly 400 employees on their understanding of some of these issues,
sure.
Race, racial equity, diversity, inclusion, and how they perceived either problems, interactions, issues, et cetera. And I think some of what the survey found is really instructive, because as our listeners kind of follow this conversation, you can think of sort of the circles that you move in your own life, whether it's in sort of social circles, work circles. How would you feel about these kind of questions? Because the majority of or at least a plurality of the survey respondents were white women, but there was a wide range of people participated in the group. We're talking about employees who were white, African-American, multiracial, Asian, American Indian, Alaskan Native, Pacific Island, Native Hawaiian, but the majority, again, or at least a plurality, were white women. So before we get to some of that, Willie, let me ask you,
sure. If
this kind of project, if this kind of work is successful,
yes.
What changes?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, I have to give my hats off to the mayor and council for supporting this work. I, in my lifetime, have never seen government take on such a controversial topic as race. Normally, oftentimes, those are things that people tell you to keep out of the workplace, race and religion. So for this leadership, this administration, this mayor to take on this initiative, a national initiative for that matter, to bring it locally, I think is a tremendous hats off to her and for that. What this does, Evan, is this looks at our policies, our practices, and our procedures with a racial equity lens. History tells us that, you know, people of color have been historically, basically kept out of a lot of different things through history. So, I mean, we can go on and on and on about the disparities that we have amongst races, especially people of color in this country. So when we begin to look at our policy, practice, and procedures with a racial equity lens, not just having fluff, we're not just doing a training session once a year and then that's it. No, we're doing training. First, we're starting a leading by example training from the top down and from the bottom up, including all of our levels of leadership within our training, and then we have our people who are in charge of these particular departments also have created change teams within their departments, and we're looking currently at all of our policies, practices, and procedures, and how do they have an adverse impact of people of color.
All right, so let me ask the other two guests here as they sort of evaluate these kinds of efforts. You know, Tina, if this kind of work is successful, what do you think starts to change?
Well, I think the key here is that we are living in a racialized society. Structural racism is a real thing that impacts all of us on a daily basis. I think awareness and education is a key. First of all, to Councilman Lightfoot's point, this morning there was an article on the history of Rochester housing in the Democratic Chronicle about Rochester's growing city and suburbs excluded black residents, and we're talking about not a historical thing in the time of slavery. We're talking about people who are still alive today, who were systematically prevented from living in certain areas that were ghettoized and that were put in certain areas, and then systematically denied an entire group of services by the government, including, you know, trash removal. If you go to those areas, you still see lots of trash on the ground. You see sewers that are, you know, plugged up. And people have been, forced to segregate themselves. And so what I would like to see in this effort is for people to stop focusing on, we tend to look at everybody now in America and say we have equal opportunity for everybody. And people make their personal choices, and their personal choices have led them to whatever state that they're in. And that's actually not true. There have been systematic structural efforts in history that have prevented people from living together, working together, and accumulating wealth.
Let me press that point, because I think this is an important moment where some of the audience may sort of split. Sometimes it's along sort of politically ideological lines, not always. But what you just said, to some listeners, they'll say, no. People have agency. They can make decisions. They can move, sort of physically. They can move emotionally and intellectually and develop in different ways. And they have those opportunities. It may be harder, but they, generally speaking, and people who kind of talk about agency will point to the success stories, which are sometimes feel like outliers, or statistically are outliers, but they will point to those stories and say, if this child can become this adult, then who cannot? Mm-hmm. And generally, because I know you've encountered that argument many, many times, what do you say to that?
I think that that ignores the entire precedent. I mean, we are all born into a certain station, a certain, I myself am one of those people that you might say, okay, there's a success story of someone who grew up in poverty that was an immigrant. I'll tell you, my circumstances changed when my mother remarried to an American lawyer in Rochester who had wealth. I became adjacent to a whole nother world of people and individuals that I would not have been exposed to in living in the low-income neighborhood that I was living in previously. I think that there are personal stories to overcome that, but more importantly, there's facts. I mean, there's data. I would encourage people to read articles like the one that came out today. It sets forth there were laws, there were practices, and you didn't have to be a racist necessarily to engage in those. It wasn't necessarily that. I think, of course, we have a racist history, but I think more importantly, there's profit motive involved. It was profitable for people to racially segregate the city. It's not that someone decided, I'm going to go out and be a racist and be part of the Ku Klux Klan. The real estate agents went out to certain areas of the city and told people, hey, the blacks are coming, move out. And that decreased the values of houses for real estate companies to buy those houses and then resell them to black folks later who moved into those houses and sell them at a much higher profit. And so maybe their motive was not racism. Maybe it was something like a profit motive, which I think everyone can agree is something that is a foundation of American culture and society. And so, you just need to look at the facts. It's not about people making personal choices to be racist, to be anti-racist. There are structural issues that are at play, and we don't come to Rochester with the history that we have on an equal playing field. People have been allowed, and I think the mayor's office has created a community wealth building initiative that VLSP has been very involved with. And the idea there is intergenerational wealth, people who, your family might have been allowed to purchase a house. And that is, in America, the way that people accumulate and retain wealth intergenerationally. You leave that house, you put in equity. Now, if you were not allowed to buy a house and your parents had to rent the entire time, there will be no intergenerational wealth passed on to you. So, as much as people say people are in conditions because of personal choices, I would challenge any of those people to say, the circumstances that you were born in, you probably did not make any personal choices that got you there. You inherited a history and a system which has been racialized.
All right. So one more point before I turn to Hank then. When it comes to goals then going forward, another sort of stumbling point along in sort of the social discourse right now is the question of what might be the goal of any project or initiative. And to sort of boil it down, those who are skeptical of this kind of work, from the Jordan Petersons of the world all across society, would say that their concern is that you are trying to force or kind of steer equal outcomes where their preference is for equal opportunity, knowing that equal opportunity will never lead to perfectly equal outcomes. Mm-hmm. Is that a straw man? Or is it,
how that do is you a straw man. That's a straw man. There's not equal opportunity. I mean, we can talk about the difference between equity and equality. I think people think, you know, there's no reparations that have been paid for the things that have happened. We have a society where if you injure somebody, you go to court, you get paid back for the losses that were, you know, your injuries and your compensated. Everyone has been, you know, everyone gets compensated for wrongs that have been suffered to them. And that is a system that we've set up, except we've made an exception where it goes to one of the worst atrocities in history of slavery and the not just slavery. I'm talking about Jim Crow all the way up to the present. And we've never addressed those things. So, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, well we're sorry, but everyone doesn't start from the same place. Equity means that some people are getting have an advantage over others. So they may have the same quote unquote opportunity, but they are not equally able to avail themselves of those opportunities. And they're starting from very, very different places. And we have to recognize that. You can't just say, you know, today there's no more racism in the world, there's no more bad laws, and, you know, now everyone will just be able to catch up.
Hank, how do you view the possible outcomes of this kind of work and the possible benefits?
I think I'm going to draw on Tina's wonderful set of stories there to try and paint a picture of what those might be, Evan. Each one of those examples that Tina gave is an example that each of us lives in one way or the other. Whether we're doing it on purpose or not, we're living in an environment in which all those examples of systemic and sustained impacts of racism are still playing out. We brought Ibram Kendi, Dr. Kendi, from American University to Rochester back in November. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, How to Be an Anti-Racist. And his message is essentially that by living, each of us contributes either to a racist or an anti-racist outcome of the behaviors which we're impacting. So that every decision we make, every interaction we enjoy, is one way or another contributing to whether or not we're going to perpetuate the kind of inequities that Tina was outlining.
Zero-sum game. So,
well, it's more than a zero-sum game. It's that we're each contributing to a larger, broader vision of capacity of humanity. I mean, I don't want to get overly dramatic here, but if each of us has a role to play that either benefits from or has historically contributed to these racist impacts, then each of us has a role we can play to either stop it from happening, reduce its impact, or continue its impact. If each of us has a role we can play, each of us has a responsibility to come to grips with and recognize the role we can play. If each of us recognizes the responsibility we have, then each of us with some degree of intentionality should make a decision that we're going to do something about that responsibility. And if we act with intentionality, then we should be looking for the tools that help us do something about it. And if we have the tools, then we should be looking for a community of resources and support, others who we can join with to help make the impact we're trying to have broader and more sustainable. And if we're doing all that, then we need vehicles for accountability to make sure that what we're doing individually and collectively actually has impact, actually results in change. I think that's in part what is my optimism that let's get real, has the potential of changing the conversation, changing the reflection, changing the intentionality, developing tools, building community, and if all of us are doing this, we should all be holding ourselves accountable.
So one more follow-up for you, because you used a phrase earlier this hour that I want to just explore a little bit with you. Hank, when you take a look at, in your words, the juncture of racism and leadership, especially when you put it in the lens of Dr. Kendi's work, acknowledging if we accept the premise that all of our actions either contribute to a reducing the gap of inegalitarianism and inequality or increasing the gap. When you look at leadership, do you see typically, and I'll use a strong phrase that maybe Dr. Kendi would use, but he would probably use it more clinical as opposed to some of the more incendiary way it would be taken. Racist leadership, I'm not talking about in any specific office. I'm talking about generally speaking in this country. Racist leadership in that it contributes to a widening of the gap, or anti-racist leadership, and is that changing?
Let's be very clear about the message of Kendi here. We see a lot of leaders who don't really do racism and really, you know, don't want to get involved in racism, or will say, God, that's a terrible thing. We shouldn't do racism. But Kendi's message is it's a very dichotomous worldview. You are either perpetuating racism, or you are an anti-racist.
Intentionally
who is
or not,
doing something.
Right? Intentionally or not.
Well, let's just stay with the intentionality
okay,
for
sure,
the moment.
Sure.
Because all of us who are white grew up with enough of racism in our worldview, our experience, our lives, our families, our churches and synagogues, our schools, etc. We all grew up with enough of it that it's going to be really hard for us to excise all of it from who we are as people. I know that I find often that little thing that I draw out and I realize what a damned racist notion that was that you were holding. And I try and pull it out and do something about it. We all carry that, everybody who's white, and actually you don't have to be white. Kendi would argue that anybody on any side of the color line is susceptible to racism. But the solution is in what you choose to do with the realization of that. The definition of who you are as a person is what you choose and who you choose to be in relationship to that. So if you choose to recognize it and to do something that changes that worldview, that behavior, and then ultimately to use who you are to fight it, then that makes you something other than a racist. So I think we ought to focus on what we can control. We can control what we are and what we do intentionally. And if we just have impact on that intentionality, we'll go a long way.
So as we look at what the survey tells us here, because a lot of things have happened in just the last year with the Let's Get Real initiative, and again, REAL standing for race, equity, and leadership. But part of it was a survey in which, you know, more than 400 employees in the city of Rochester were asked questions. I'm going to read a few examples of what the survey found, and then I'm going to ask our guests to kind of highlight what they think will sort of be instructive and be kind of building blocks for change. The survey showed that more engagement with the Hispanic and Latino community is necessary at City Hall. Respondents agreed that being informed on race and racism, along with receiving training and support, would better equip them to advance equity within the workplace. Respondents agreed that the training sessions and workshops about race and racism were extremely useful in the charge to examine public policy. Black women stated that they were most likely to attend workshops on race and found them helpful. And the study showed that they were also more likely to speak up about issues of race, whereas other groups and genders were not. Despite understanding the concepts of racial equity and the value of conversations surrounding race and racism, the majority of respondents stated that they sometimes or rarely set aside their own discomfort to talk about race. And respondents said that they were often feeling unclear about the differences in terms of definition between race, racial equity, diversity, inclusion. Willie, what stands out? The whole list stands out. Every one of those points is important.
I agree.
But you know, what stands out to you that says this is going to help lead to a path of change, and probably in shorter order than later?
Yeah, very good question. And the survey definitely helps to guide us to where we need to put our training at, what types of trainings that we need to have. And I just want to take a quick moment, Evan, just to shout out to the rest of the core team members, Dr. Lomax Campbell, Leticia Andrette Doucette, Dr. Rose Nichols, Thad Harris, also to Who am I missing here? Candace Lucas, and also to the Director of Human Resources, Tassie Demps, as well. I really wanted to bring out the fact that this effort has been a group of individuals who have been working tirelessly to try to break the surface of this racial equity conversation. The survey, in my opinion, one of the things that came out of it says employees feel they feel that race discussion on race is necessary. So that right there shows that this is important. It's important to the employees. They want to have this discussion. And I think all of the other pieces that you brought out, Evan, just shows that maybe they don't know how to have this discussion. Because, again, this is something that has been taboo to the workplace. So when you're speaking about something, race and religion, I run a barbershop. So, of course, you know, in the barbershop, you can talk about anything.
There's no third rails.
You know what I mean?
When you go to work.
Right. So it's a very safe place, right? But when you go into places like government and you're worried about your job and you're worried about what our guiding principles are and all of the policies and the procedures that tell you not to do certain things on your job, not even on your lunch hour, you can get in trouble for. So we're taking a cap off of something that's been sealed for so long, and then now it's opening up a lot of emotions, opening up a lot of feelings from people. And I would say that the People's Institute of Survival and Beyond training that we have had of undoing racism was absolutely amazing. And the thing about this is we're not just asking our employees to do this. City Council is getting ready to go through this training in October. The mayor, the deputy mayor, all of SMT or the senior management team, and we're taking the Police Accountability Board, 9 members, through this as well too. So we're not just asking, and one of the survey things said they want leadership. They want to see leadership doing this as well. So leading by example. They don't just want, we want the employees. It's like a sexual harassment training. You know, you do it one time on a computer, you're done for the year. Like this is not what the intention of this program or this initiative is. This initiative is to really begin to look at all of our policies and practices and procedures, as well as continuing the conversation with our employees with a racial equity lens to get people to start. This is not an afterthought. It's not something we just added. That this is embedded into who we are as a city of Rochester. And I think that when we look at the survey, it helps to guide us to how to continue to develop our core teams. Every department has a core team that now breaks out and they meet monthly to discuss parts of the survey, to discuss how can they better engage in this type of conversation. For the first time in our city budget, we are going to be instituting an equity tool where we're asking questions to each department that are racial equity questions that they have to answer in the budget this year so that we can begin to hold each department accountable for some of the work that we're doing. We recognize the opportunity to have more engagement with the Hispanic population. So one thing City Council we just did, if you look online and go to our job sites, we have a position that's open now for our clerk position within the City Council office, and we're presenting that position as a bilingual position. We're actually looking for someone that is Spanish-speaking or a Latino person for that position. So again, the information from the survey is helping us to engage in the areas that we're falling short in. We realize that we need to engage that population more. Well, not just engage, how about we employ them? I mean, we're showing more of skin in the game when we're not just, we just want to talk to you, have a program. And there was a program this morning with Hispanic population down here today with the mayor. And so we're not talking about just having a conversation. We need to lead by example and hire individuals, people of color, as well as continuing these conversations. So I think that also I want to mention Dr. Rose Nickel. I think I did mention her as well. But you know, that's what I get from the survey. It's helping to guide us to be intentional, as Dr. Hank was talking about. We have to be intentional in our discussions and our conversations, and we have to make sure that we're creating safe places for people to have these conversations and really express how they feel. When we were having these conversations with the National Institute, People's Institute of Survival and Beyond, people were talking about things that I don't think they've ever talked about that have happened in their household, things that they've seen with their family members. So they had to feel comfortable in order to have that conversation. There were some people who, we hear stories of people who said they never knew they were white until they were in college. They never were told that. You know what I mean? They never saw a difference in themselves until they were in college and they saw a difference between how they were treated and how some of their people of color friends were treated. And then they realized that they had white privilege. And some, whereas a person of color knows that from the time they're 3 years old. They know that, you know what I mean, that they are a person of color and they have to live with that for their entire life. So I think that there's some very significant distinctions among that. And when you talk about racism, the definition that the People's Institute of Survival and Beyond uses is that race prejudice plus power equals racism. So when you look at that as the definition, it really brings into context what we're talking about here.
Anything from the survey surprise you, Councilman?
You know what surprised me was the fact that people said that they didn't feel like they had time. That was one of the things they said. Well, one of the barriers was we don't feel like we have time to have this conversation. So that just shows you that it's not a part of their everyday life. So we have to say that this is something that we don't go make time for. This is something that becomes a part of our conversation as we go through our daily business and as in a way that we conduct business from now on. So I think when people look at it as, oh, that's something extra that we have to do, and not that this is a part of who we are, that's the challenging thing that we're going to have to change in the culture of our city.
I've got some feedback from listeners I want to get to. Couple of emails, phone calls. If you want to weigh in on the program, you can do that at 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. And you can email the program connections@wxxi.org. We're talking about this program, the Let's Get Real initiative. It's an initiative supported by the National League of Cities, and you're hearing from the Vice President of Rochester City Council. Willie Lightfoot is with us. Tina Foster is Executive Director of the Volunteer Legal Services of Monroe County, and she has been a civil rights lawyer for a couple of decades now. Hank Rubin is the founding director of the Frederick Douglass Center for Collaborative Leadership. That's a program of Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. Your feedback on the other side of our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, Venezuelans are suffering under an oppressive regime and a humanitarian crisis. Last night at the State of the Union, President Donald Trump welcomed Juan Guaido of Venezuela and declared him the true and legitimate leader. But back in Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro is clinging to power while millions suffer. What happens next? What should happen next? What's the impact of U.S. foreign policy? We discuss it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let me read some feedback, and then we'll take some phone calls as well. Benjamin says, way back in the 70s when I was in elementary school, one of Dr. King's inner circle came to speak to us. I don't recall who it was at this stage anymore, unfortunately, but I will never forget what he said. Racism is like rain. If it's not falling, it's always forming. This broke my heart as a kid in second or third grade, and it has stayed with me all these years, and hearing about programs like this gives me hope. So thank you. That comes from Benjamin. Rick says, white people have enjoyed advantages and privileges in educational access and career opportunity for generations now. The beneficiaries are unlikely to relinquish the advantages and privileges easily. So how do we address this issue? Let's go around the table. I'll start with Hank. What would you say to Rick, Hank?
Relinquish is a really hard word.
And do you disagree with that premise?
Well, I'm not sure we have to relinquish anything other than the expectation that we inherit the right not to have to compete, not to have to do our job well, not to have to be good people. You know, the concept of privilege rests so much on the fact that I, as a white guy, I'm a tall guy, I've got a full head of hair, and I can walk into a room and people expect me to lead. I start saying something, and all too often people will say, well, you know, that's what he's supposed to do. And if I were not white, and if I were black, if I were female, if I were short, if I were bald, if I were anything other than that, would that expectation obtain? And when we live in a community where the expectations are no different, then we're talking about relinquishing. So let me say that again, it's not that his name is Steve.
Rick.
Rick. Rick, it's not a matter of us having to give up. It's a matter of us recognizing, being intentional about reflecting on what we are doing to fight and reduce inequity. Is what we're doing having an impact that reduces privilege and improves equity, or are we enjoying and living off the inequity of the expectations of privilege?
Okay. Tina?
I'd say, you know, there's a self-interest here. Whether you're white, black, person of color, you have some stake in this work, because whether you choose to acknowledge it or not, I mean, I think of the racialized, society that we live in. It's like, you know, being in a fish in the water that doesn't know it's wet. You can either acknowledge that this is in the water. We are all living in this environment and operating in this environment, where you can decide not to recognize it and not deal with it. But it impacts yourself, as whether you're white or black or anybody else. You will miss out on understanding, knowledge, and in fact, there are business articles about the costs of not addressing racism to the workplace, to our society, to the advancement of our society. The amount of money that taxpayers have to pay for the effects of the racism that occur in our society is great. We all bear the burden of a racist society. So whether or not I'm part of the privileged or not privileged, I am a victim of a racist society.
Willie.
First of all, Rick, I think that is an excellent question. I really do. I think it starts with, it's really the challenge that we have before us. We have to figure out ways of getting people to, one, acknowledge. Acknowledgement is the first step to turning around and getting yourself back on track of where you need to be. I think then we have to continue to raise awareness and training. Training, I think, is the number one key goal of getting individuals who may feel that way, who may feel that, okay, I don't want to give up anything. Because I think, as Tina was saying, we have to show them the value of humanity, that the value of having diversity, inclusion, looking at things with a racial equity lens, especially for those that are in business. Once you begin to see the value in it, and because at the end of the day, people are looking at their bottom line, if they're businessmen or women, and I think companies are really paying attention. We look all across the board. We even look at the Grammys. I mean, this was a major thing this year in the Grammys, and people were really speaking out against or for diversity, inclusion, racial equity, even within a lot of our systematic structural organizations that have been around for decades. So I think when that's going to be the challenge. How do we get people to see that this is something that they need to acknowledge, they need to raise their awareness with, and then be willing to go and have training and be willing to go into a place that maybe they haven't been before with them, with their own personal selves in the mirror.
Go ahead, Hank. You want to add to that?
Yeah, I just as in the changing demographics of America, we all know that one of the big battles going on in politics and in the economy is that whites are going, within the next decades, slip from being the majority to being a minority.
Mm-hmm. Or plurality, I guess, for a little while.
That's right.
Yeah, but right. But not an outright majority. Yes.
But not an outright majority. Thanks. And that has impact in ways that are not shouldn't invoke fear, but should invoke a sort of a market analysis, so that if we have historically white organizations, whether they're businesses or consulting groups or nonprofit vehicles, that have historically been white, have a reputation of being historically white, and have had an historically white market and market plan. As the market changes, the organization itself, if it wants to stay in front of the market in order to be able to benefit from the changing economy, the organization itself has to take on the challenge of tackling its own internal racism and its own reputation and its own presentation of self in public. So that attention to developing as an anti-racist organization, an organization that promotes equity and that presents a reputation and image of promoting equity, becomes a marketplace issue for more and more organizations as we move into the new politics and the new economy.
Let me grab a phone call. This is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I grew up in Buffalo in the 50s and 60s, and the racism was pretty rampant. But since then, I think things have diminished substantially. And I'd like to ask your panel if they have any familiarity with a couple black educators who would take an opposite viewpoint. Shelby Steele and Candace Owens, I've heard, among others, but I've heard them in discussions, in documentaries, and I've read some of their writings, and they would disagree with the track that you're on. They take the philosophy that it's a question of embracing freedom and taking advantage of the freedoms we have in place right now in 2020. Number one, has the panel heard or read any of Shelby Steele or Candace Owens' writings?
John, let me just jump in, and I would ask you to frame your own argument. I mean, Candace Owens is a grifter, and she her work is...
That's your opinion.
Okay. She's a grifter. Read Kathy Young. Kathy Young is a libertarian writer who doesn't have a whole lot of...
Shelby.
Hold on.
Shelby Steele.
Kathy Young is a libertarian writer who does not have a whole lot of affinity for the social justice movement. She wrote a really effective piece.
I didn't mention
piece.
Kathy Young. What about Shelby Steele?
I'm talking about Candace Owens. I'm trying to help you see that the person you're citing isn't really an intellectually honest or good faith writer. Yes, okay. I mean, she's not a good faith writer. There's a big marketplace. There's a lot of money.
That shows a lot of prejudice, I think.
No, okay. John.
I'd like to get your panel.
But John, you're just pointing to writers. I'm asking you to make the arguments. Don't point to So what is? I'll ask them when the phone call's over. But what is it that they've written that you think that the panel should consider? That's what I want to know.
Well, number one, I agree with them to a point that there's been a tremendous amount of progress made in racial equity over the last 50 years. And I would agree with them from the standpoint there's a lot in place right now that can move African Americans and other people of color forward. And I think it is a question of not embracing freedom and taking advantage of freedom and not appreciating mm-hmm. the freedoms that are out there.
Okay. Stand in line, John. Fair question. And I'll let our panel respond.
Yeah. I think I kind of understand where he's coming from, but I would have to push back on that to say that I remember when Bill Cosby came out and said, hey, you know, black men, you need to get off the couch and just go get a job, you know, and that was his philosophy, that people aren't taking advantages of the opportunities that are out there available to them. So there are African-American people of color who would make that argument. However, we're not talking about people that are lazy. we're talking about structural racism, and we're talking about systemic issues that are embedded into people's policy practices and procedures and in their systems. So when we do power analysis, the systems were literally created. Laws were put in place, redlining. When you look at things that were structurally put in place to not even give you an opportunity to have those opportunities. And then when you know, that's not just people being lazy. These are things that were intentional. So this work that we're talking about is we're talking about undoing racism.
Well, Willie, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure, sir. Absolutely.
I did not insinuate. I didn't want to make the point. I did not insinuate the point that laziness is part of it. I'm talking about awareness.
Mm-hmm. That's where I think I push back at, because I think that there's a difference between the people you're citing and what they're saying as opposed to the work that we're doing. I agree with you that a lot of progress has been made down through the years. But I would tell you that when you look at that progress, when you look at the data will show you that the progress is not structural.
Willie, are you familiar with Shelby Steele?
Not really, no.
Well, you should look into it, his writings. He's an educator, I think, out of Berkeley, one of the universities out there.
Okay.
And Candace Owens, it sounds like you know who she is. But anyway, I'm sorry.
Well, thanks for the question, though, or the statement.
Yeah, I mean, anything else? Hank, Tina, you want to add to that?
Well, I'd
I'd land on the word awareness here and say that that's exactly right. If we're going to use the concept of freedom as a starting point for our expectations of how we should address any social problem, then we have to be aware of the impediments and the hurdles that differentiate access to freedom for any groups of people. And insofar as we historically have created impediments and barriers and hurdles, that we've put ankle weights on certain groups of people in the marathon and not on others, to simply lift it all at one moment and say, wherever you are in that marathon, we're giving you freedom to pursue the outcomes and the goals and the expectation that everybody has an equal and fair shot to hit that finish line together, that's just not reasonable. And I'm familiar with the writings, and I think there are holes in the principled foundation for how they frame the issue.
I'm not familiar with the writings, but I am familiar with thousands of people who come through our agency and other civil legal service providers, that we look at what the issues that are being faced. People do not have good choices. It's not about making a good or bad choice. If you have $500 and you have to choose between medical care for your child, a babysitter, or paying your rent, it's not that you're a deadbeat and decided not to pay your rent. You don't have the money to do it all. You have to make difficult choices. I have never been in the position where I've had to make those kind of choices. It's not about freedom. The children, Rochester has the worst poverty rate of a city of its size in a number of categories, including infant mortality, a place where we have the University of Rochester and top-notch medical facilities. Our babies are dying. What choice did those babies have, when they came into this world? Do we want to be a society where we don't care about our neighbors? We're talking about a difference between a zip code, of a mile between the haves and the have-nots here in Rochester. You just need to open your eyes.
Yeah, and John, just to kind of put a final point on it, Candace Owens is not a serious writer, but there are serious writers of color who would disagree with certain either aspects of this discussion or approach. Writers like perhaps Chidike Okeem, Thomas Chatterton Williams, John McWhorter, Raihan Salam. Those are names that I think would gain a lot more currency if you want to have a serious dialogue, as opposed to someone like Candace Owens. But I appreciate the phone call, and we've got a few minutes left here. So, Councilman Lightfoot, why don't you sort of chart the sure. path forward here? So what comes out of this next?
So the next thing that we will be doing is the community empowerment piece, because the Undoing Racism trainings are going to be ongoing. Of course, I told you that we have the city, the mayor, city council, as well as all of SMT going through that training. Community-level discussions that we're going to be starting doing this year. Racial healing efforts, we're going to be creating safe spaces. I'm doing some stuff in barbershops and salons around safe spaces to have these conversations. And we're working on also putting together a real commission. So this work needs to lie in a body of people, right, so that we can institutionalize it within our – it shouldn't determine who's the mayor, who's city council. This stuff has to be embedded in our work. So that those are some of the next – and creating toolkits and playbooks, we call them, that we're going to be having for organizations. So for instance, if a not-for-profit wants to get some of our training information or wants to know how to start this work in their organization, we're going to have toolkits that we're developing for organizations as well.
Hank?
Along with that, there's also the continuation of partnerships with other organizations
sure.
that support elements of the same mission. Mm-hmm. So that REGI, Racial Equity and Justice Initiatives, is the vehicle for promoting a year-long or an 18-month-long intense program of change with change teams from each of 9 different agencies or departments in the city, where each of these departments' leadership teams or change teams is focused on essential internal elements that if changed would change the climate, the racial climate within that department, so that we're actually looking for intentional change, sustainable change, change that involves both structure and the culture, how people deal with each other in each of those departments. And there are a number of other, REAL is really also a vehicle for sort of convening and supporting multiple I don't know, collaborative relationships that all can contribute with a shared vision that we're all in this together trying to fight the same demon.
Okay. You want to add to that, Tina?
I'll just add, you know, from our perspective and our organization, I think the work that we're doing in trying to raise awareness with using attorneys that from the community that are normally completely immune from the type of issues that are being faced by people of poverty and people of color primarily in the city, having them be able to understand, I think that and engage with those segments of our population improves, it desegregates us in a big way. And I think we're going to stay committed to that. The real initiative, I think it's great that the city has taken leadership on that, but all of us in the business community are going to have to step up to actually effectuate those changes.
I want to thank our guests for being here. And this is the kind of program where we ought to keep revisiting this. Councilman,
yes.
Vice President Lightfoot,
sure.
Will you come back and keep us informed on
Absolutely.
This? We appreciate that. It's the Let's Get Real initiative, Race, Equity, and Leadership. Willie Joe Lightfoot is President of Rochester City Council. Tina Foster, Executive Director of Volunteer Legal Services of Monroe County. Hank Rubin, Founding Director of the Frederick Douglass Center for Collaborative Leadership, a program of Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. Can you believe that was 52 minutes?
It
just blinked.
Quick. It did.
Let's come back and talk some more here. More connections coming up.